Venezuela's dictator dances. Right outside, people suffer and die. It's so cruel and unnecessary. Venezuela should be rich. Not long ago, Venezuela was the richest country in Latin America. It still has greater oil reserves than Saudi Arabia. But today, Venezuelans starve. These people are fighting over bags of flour.
No hay alimentos, no hay nada.
And then there's the violence. One Venezuelan is murdered every 20 minutes. So are American celebrities who praised Hugo Chavez's People's Revolution now embarrassed by what they said? Will they admit they were wrong? Leftist intellectual Noam Chomsky fawned over Chavez, said he's made a better world.
See how a better world is being created and can speak to the person who's inspired it.
Actor Sean Penn met with Chavez and said this.
He's done the moment incredible things for the 80% of the people that are very poor there.
Actor Danny Glover did some playful boxing and hugging with Chavez. Then he praised his vision for humanity. Michael Moore claimed Chavez eliminated 75% of extreme poverty.
Come on, Michael. Chavez added to extreme poverty.
Who is Hugo Chavez?
Director Oliver Stone made this insipid film celebrating Chavez and Latin American socialism.
Take an incredible look at an extraordinary movement.
Pela primeira vez, os pobres estão sendo tratados como seres humanos.
No, they're not. Now they starve and fear they'll be killed.
Model Naomi Campbell went to Venezuela and said, I'm amazed to see the love for the social programs.
We asked all of them if they'd talk about their love of Chavez. Only one responded, Noam Chomsky. His anti-capitalist teachings have misled millions of students, but they've worked for Chomsky.
After he praised Chavez's sharp poverty reduction, Chavez returned the favor by holding up Chomsky's book at the UN. That made it a bestseller.
So is Chomsky now ashamed of his praise? No, he wrote me. He said at the time he praised Chavez, Venezuela had seen a remarkable reduction in poverty. He cited this Harvard Magazine article. But this was written by a leftist who helped write Oliver Stone's movie. So I asked Chomsky, given the current crisis in Venezuela, should you now say to the students who've learned from you, socialism wrecks people's lives? Chomsky wrote me back, I never described Chavez's state capitalist government as socialist. Private capitalism remained. Capitalists were free to undermine the economy in all sorts of ways, like massive export of capital. What? Capitalists exported capital and undermined the economy by abandoning their homes and fleeing across the border to Colombia?
Thousands of Venezuelans cross daily in search of food, medicine, and work.
These people are socialist fools, useful idiots, Lenin would have called them. As much as I'd enjoy rubbing their noses in their stupidity now, I cannot rejoice because I know Venezuela's descent into chaos will not be the last time we hear of a dying socialist economy.
Socialism failed in all these places. We are yet to see one socialist country succeed.
And yet, sadly, they and other countries refuse to learn the lessons of history. Other countries will give socialism a go. Useful idiots will sing socialism's praises until the last light goes out.
Are you sick of government lackeys who say you didn't build that? Are you tired of elitists who think you need a government permission slip for everything? Everything you do is an A to B conversation, and the government should see their way out of it. Create true free markets by adopting the BIPCOT No Government License. The BIPCOT No Gov License allows use or modification of any product, service, or software except by governments or government agents.
Go to BIPCOT.org. That's Bravo, India, Papa, Charlie, Oscar, Tango.org.
My fellow sheep, election season is upon us. Are you one of the 12% of Americans who still approves of our government? Then we need your help to force the other 88% into compliance. Our democracy depends on it. We're an organization called Citizens Against Too Much Unfettered Freedom, or CATMUF. CATMUF is a bipartisan flock of sheep whose goal is expanding government until nothing else remains. Because the government is here to help you. How can you help CatMuff help you? By only voting for candidates dedicated to expanding government. It's easy. You don't need to study the issues. No matter what a politician says when running for office, they're all dedicated to expanding government. And make sure you tell all your friends and family to vote for more government. Here at CatMuff, we don't care if you vote Democrat or Republican, as long as you vote for candidates committed to growing our federal family. CatMuff. Because folks just aren't smart enough to handle real freedom.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Peaceful Anarchism on the Voluntary Virtues Network on theconsciousresistance.com and solpodcast.org. So today I'm delighted to have Jose Nino, who is a libertarian voluntarist coming out of Colorado. You can find him on Twitter at Jose A.L. Nino or on Facebook under Jose Nino. On Mises.org, you can find many of his articles where he's a prolific writer. Just look for Jose Nino, or you can type Jose, Mises.org/profile/Jose-Nino. And you'll find his voluminous work there on various topics. So he was born in Venezuela, and he's got family in Venezuela. And so naturally, we will talk about Venezuela. He has family there, so he understands, a very up close and personal experience of what's going on down there, as well as through his own research and understanding of economics and monetary theory and things like that. So we're going to get into what's going on in Venezuela. And why socialism is perhaps not the best way to go about organizing society, and what exactly is hyperinflation? Because this is really, I think, a very instructive situation if people can learn something from it. So, Jose, thanks a lot for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me on, Nilo.
No problem, no problem. I heard you a couple of times on Tom Woods. Very informative, very instructive. I really appreciate that. And also on the Peace and Liberty podcast with Stephen Clyde, I think his name is. And that was really awesome. So I'm like, I got to get this guy on my show because this is something. And I know you talked about it a lot with various people, but it can't be talked about enough because, you know, warning people of the dangers of socialism is something that can never get old, I think, because, you know, as we know, it seems like every state, every nation state has as its end goal, whether stated or unstated, complete totalitarian control or socialistic control of its economy. So this is a great example of what that looks like. But before we get into that, can you tell my audience about your background, how you came to libertarianism?
Well, as I mentioned before, I was born in Venezuela, but I came to the United States when I was relatively young, around 6. This was the mid to late 1990s, and the situation in Venezuela was already starting to get bad. My parents, with the tea leaves and everything, and decided to go in search of greener pastures. And I lived in the States, specifically Texas, for pretty much the majority of my life. And during my time there, I came across the ideas of Ron Paul around 2007 and was just hooked to his message about free market money, ending the Federal Reserve, limited government, and just getting the government out of our lives altogether. So it really resonated with me, and I took that into my college years and got involved with a lot of libertarian groups. I eventually headed up a libertarian group at the University of Texas at Austin, and I've lived abroad as well. I've lived in Chile for 2 years, came back to the States. Now I work as like a political consultant and writer for various organizations, and I still talk about a lot of libertarian stuff, especially in domestic matters. I do write about Venezuela as well, not as much before, but the topic is something that I like to inform people about when asked about it, because I do think it is the most visceral example of socialist failure we are currently witnessing.
Yeah, and it's especially important now, given that it seems like people are becoming more and more enamored by the idea of socialism. You know, with Bernie Sanders, and now actually, what's a woman? Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. You heard about this woman?
Yes.
The youngest congresswoman, right? Go ahead.
Yes. Her story is just crazy. And I think it actually, what's scary about Ocasio-Cortez is the fact that she's like the microcosm of what a lot of millennials think. She is almost a perfect embodiment. That's why I think she's very scary, due to the fact that a lot of people are going to grow up with her in politics. She's already in the spotlight without even taking office yet. And
yeah,
it's pretty bad if her ideas start to gain more relevance.
Yes, you're right. She is very reflective of the zeitgeist of the times, in that, yeah, a lot of millennials, yeah, they have this idea, you know, people walking around with, you know, what's it called? The Che Guevara t-shirts. Like people.
Oh, yes. You know,
people have this idea of socialism. I don't understand it. You know, it's like, how can you know so little about something and yet be so vocal as an advocate for it, you know, especially when it involves the, you know, the violence of the state, you know?
Well, that's actually ironically testament to how good a lot of legacy institutions like the academia, the media,
right,
a lot of leftist politicians and grassroots activists have been when it comes to their marketing, irony aside. Because they've been able to commoditize socialism in a way that no socialist would ever dream of. I don't think Che Guevara could imagine like a world where his t-shirts probably net people millions of dollars in profit and whatnot.
Yeah. I mean, you know, a political ideology that shuns and tries to destroy private enterprise, they certainly make a lot of money selling these t-shirts. You know, one of my favorite memes or cartoons is like an anarcho-capitalist or an agorist selling, you know, Che Guevara t-shirts to a line of communists and socialists, you know, people who are advocating down with capitalism, and this agorist is making, you know, a truckload of money off of these, of the economic ignorance of the masses. So,
yeah, that's the irony.
Yeah, quite ironic.
It's very hard to explain how that phenomenon emerged.
Yeah. I mean, I don't blame people. In fact, I cheer people who are able to look at that and say, you know what, I'm going to make money off these people. I don't care if what they're, you know, promoting is evil. I'm just going to make money. I mean, I think that's pretty smart business strategy.
Yeah, that is actually a pretty smart business strategy. I do work in marketing and similar fields, and that is actually a very good strategy, because socialism is very much in vogue right now.
Yes. So, yeah, which is exactly why we must smash it, as Tom Woods would say, with a baseball bat. So please tell us about Venezuela and you know, your experiences, your family experiences of it, and, you know, you traveling back there, and what you've uncovered through your research.
Well, Venezuela has always been of interest, given my connection to the country, and I visited on numerous occasions throughout the 2000s, early like 21st century, and I just saw a country that was just getting progressively more socialist and less prosperous. You would see like lines for basic food items like toilet paper, sugar emerge. You see shortages. You'd see creeping inflation, and a government that was just confiscating property arbitrarily. And a lot of this has been part of like Venezuela's like multi-decade legacy of embracing socialism of one degree or another. something that's very missing, that's very misunderstood about Venezuela, is the country has always been, for the most part, pretty socialist. Even in the more prosperous eras of the country, state had a massive role in the economy. Government pretty much nationalized the oil industry in the 70s and turned it into a huge piggy bank for the government to buy votes, to consolidate more of their power, to reward cronyist industries, and also politicize its central bank, which the government had a majority stock in. And one fun fact that a lot of your listeners might not know is that Venezuela has not had single-digit inflation since 1983. So Venezuelan millennials have never seen a year of inflation less than 10%, and that's been part of the decay of Venezuela over the last few decades. In fact, in 1998, the average Venezuelan was poorer on a per capita GDP basis than a Venezuelan in 1958. And for that reason, Hugo Chavez was able to win resoundingly in the 1998 presidential elections because the country became poorer on net. And this was like in an era where it's like socialism was not as entrenched as it was from 1999 up until the present.
Hmm. Wow. Yeah, I remember learning about that, about how Venezuela took control of the oil manufacturing and production, and how, you know, it's very ironic how what is it, like Venezuela has like the most naturally occurring oil reserves than like any other geographic location around the world, and yet they're like you know, the shortages of various oil products is like, which to me illustrates the idea that the state, you know, when it takes control of any industry, basically destroys it. Go ahead. Sorry.
That is correct, Danilo. In fact, Venezuela is a very resource-rich country, but as we have seen, state management of economic resources is a disaster waiting to happen. One thing about the Venezuelan oil industry was that it's been nationalized since the 1970s, but at least the government did not have as much of a say in who they hired. They at least had like the most qualified people running it. Mm. But when Hugo Chavez came into power, the state-owned oil enterprise was just completely politicized, where they just fired all competent workers and put nothing but government cronies in there. That's the strongest case against the nationalization of any industry, that if some lunatic takes control, they'll just completely destroy whatever meritocratic elements were left and just stuff it with government cronies that respond to political incentives, not market incentives.
Yeah. I mean, you see that pattern all over the place, you know, like I believe in South Africa now, you know, the government is seizing farms and saying that they're being run by these white people that are keeping food from the blacks, but then once the government takes them over, then, you know, of course they just get reduced to rubble and everything rots and gets destroyed and in the end everyone suffers. So, you know, when the state takes control, you know, it's a monopoly and so there's no competition. So what is the incentive towards quality and efficiency? You know, there is no incentive and no competition. That's the beauty of the market, right?
Yes, indeed. Funny you mentioned South Africa, because I have written about South Africa recently, and it's essentially the next Venezuela in many regards.
Yeah.
It's a country that was once a regional leader in an otherwise troubled region like Africa, and in Venezuela's case, Latin America, that is now falling for the siren song of state socialism. And there, it's going to be pretty nasty if they actually follow through with this land confiscation, because say what you want about the South African white population. Yes, they have implemented terrible policies like apartheid, but they do bring like the most skilled labor that helped bring that country to its vaunted status of like the richest country in Africa for some time.
Yeah.
But that can all go to waste because of that. And the Venezuelan case is a very strong example of how if you go through really rapid land confiscation and extensive expropriation, you will completely destroy your country's productivity base, thus making it poorer.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of amusing when people, you know, illustrate, how efficient and near perfect the socialism model is. You know, they reference the Scandinavian countries, right? Was like Denmark and things like that, places like that, that have, you know, such huge high tax rates, and they say, look at these people, you know, high levels of happiness and everything and productivity and all that. And what's amusing and ironic is that the only reason that they're able to have such productivity or such, let's say, wealth is because it was created in a relatively free market, very unregulated. And so they were given the freedom to innovate and create. And now, once the government takes control, it's like, I liken it to, a parade or a parade happening. And then someone steps in front of the parade and they claim credit for the parade. So the state claims credit for the fruits that capitalism has produced.
Yes, that's actually very true. And with the Scandinavian case, it's also like basically a rich family bestowing a bunch of wealth to their children that are just profligate spenders, spending it left and right and not really creating any wealth. And a lot of these Scandinavian countries in the 90s, they had to undertake numerous reforms to get their fiscal house in order, lest they wanted to turn into something like Venezuela. Venezuela tried to do some reforms in the 1990s, and they ultimately failed and led to Hugo Chavez's rise to power. And that was all she wrote from that point forward.
Yeah, I mean, just look at any point in history, you know, when there's a really fanatical despot or tyrant that rose to power. And, you know, just look a few years or decades before, and probably that nation was in a state of turmoil, chaos, confusion, disorder. You know, people, they don't know what's happening, and they're looking to one person, you know, to lead them out of it, right? And that's a perfect, the perfect scenario for, you know, a despot like, you know, Stalin, like Hitler, like, you know, name your murderous despot in history, you know, and you can see his pattern repeat.
Yes, crisis is the lifeblood of the state and for future demagogues, especially now that you've had over a century's worth of public school indoctrination, you're going to see lots of demagoguery in the West. And it's bad because you're going to have a lot of people that are going to get really ticked off once if inflation becomes a thing, once the welfare state starts collapsing and people begging for more government and their wealth erodes. They're just going to turn to insert demagogue X. This story has played out a lot. This is nothing new in history. Look at ancient Rome. In many regards, we are following the same path as Rome. If history doesn't repeat itself, it at least rhymes.
That's one of my favorite Mark Twain quotes. actually, are you familiar with Mike Maloney from goldsilver.com?
I am not.
Yeah, he is an excellent author. He wrote a book about precious metals, but also about monetary history, about economics, free markets, things like that. And he also produced this documentary, mini documentary series called Hidden Secrets of Money. And fascinating, excellent, well-made, you know, animated, and just very educational, informative, free on YouTube. And actually, interesting you mentioned Rome, because so far he's made 10 episodes, and the last two episodes both cover the parallels of the path that the United States is on and ancient Rome and the moments that led up to the collapse of ancient Rome and how they, you know, pretty much mirror what's going on in the United States in terms of, you know, debasing the money, in terms of spending massively on public works, in terms of imperialism. you know, and all these kind of, you know, and you know, some of the things was happening in Venezuela, you know, and seizing the control of industries and imposing price controls, wage controls, things like that. So, yeah, fascinating parallels.
Yeah, if you want to understand politics, read up on your history. I actually was like a history major. I focused mainly on like East Asia and Latin America, but I've read history from all over. To truly understand politics, if you have a good grasp of history, you'll be good to go, because a lot of things that we see today have happened before, or some variant of it have happened before. And there's just a lot of historical ignorance these days because of the fact that, like, the education system is terrible. That's what happens when you let the state control it and monopolize it. You have tons of people coming out of history departments and economics departments filled with either Marxism, Keynesianism, or whatever statist flavor of the week ideology is in vogue. It's pretty bad. And with this whole Venezuelan thing, I think when it's said and done, you're probably going to see historians downplay as much as possible and give really weak excuses, like saying, oh, it's just low commodity prices, corruption, mismanagement, yada, 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 while ignoring the elephant in the living room that is socialism.
Yeah, can you get into because one thing I enjoy talking to people about is economics, especially monetary economics, because most people have no idea about it, they have no opinion on it. And so it's something that I think a lot of people are open to hearing. Like, for example, certain topics are much more sensitive to most people. Like, for example, immigration. A lot of people have, you know, strong opinions about immigration. Maybe taxation. People have strong opinions on taxation, right? Or welfare, let's say. People have strong opinions on welfare. But you talk about Federal Reserve, they don't know if you know anything about it. What about, you know, what do you think the interest rate should be? They don't care. What do they care? They have no idea, you know? So, yeah, that's why monetary economics to me is something that I'd like
that's
to
actually a good.
Go ahead.
That's actually a good point, Danilo. I'm no monetary expert, but I am relatively well-read on the subject of central banking. And it is one of the more taboo subjects that we see in academia and just like in general, like media and politics, because when you actually look at it, the 20th century megastate, like the progressive megastate we've seen over the last century or so, central banking's at the core of it, because when you're able to inflate a currency out the wazoo and control it, you can finance whatever sweetheart political program politicians want to have, because back then you'd have to tax people, and with direct taxation, a lot of people at least could see the blatant like cost of that type of taxation, how it affected them and burdened them. And you'd see tax revolts practically in every society throughout history due to excessive taxation. Now with inflation, it gets more insidious, because it's like a slow and creeping form of taxation that is technically disconnected from a type of political accountability mechanism. Because at least in theory, you could vote the bums out of office if they raise your taxes and stuff like that. But with inflation, it's controlled by bureaucrats, by Federal Reserve bureaucrats that can stay in their position indefinitely. And it's very difficult to attack because they work in the shadows. It's basically the deep state. You all just talk about the deep state in the Trump era. Reality is the deep state's been around since the Federal Reserve was created. In fact, it's enabled by it. And you can make the argument that it is the deep state as well. And the Federal Reserve and all these other central banks, like say like the Venezuelan Central Bank, have been absolutely destructive when it comes to destroying people's wealth and concentrating political power in the government and its cronies.
Yeah, yeah, it's such an important point, you know, talking about the Federal Reserve with people because, yeah, so many people are just completely ignorant. So for that reason, can you please get into some details about Venezuela and what's going on with the hyperinflation, like how fast are prices rising? And, you know, because I know that, you know, Jeff Berwick went down there. He did some videos about, you know, showing, you know, the the prices in like restaurants have to be changed every day. I don't know. Do people get paid every day? You know, and things like that. Can you get into a little bit about that?
Well, I haven't really kept up with the inflation rates lately because Venezuela's in hyperinflationary mode now. It's been in hyperinflationary mode since 2016. And for a country to be technically in hyperinflation, an economist, Philip Kagan, said that its monthly inflation rate has to be at least like 50% or higher.
Oh, shoot. Wow.
One figure I saw actually for Venezuela was that inflation was at 65,000% or something like that. Some insane number. And it's not really surprising because there were some reports from the Venezuelan Central Bank in 2017, especially toward the end of the year, that the central bank was increasing the money supply by 10% on a weekly basis. So it's not shocking why Venezuela reached this point. And as far as how people get paid, lots of sectors of the Venezuelan economy are already like de facto dollarized, meaning that people are relying on dollars in the black market to like store their wealth and conduct their transactions because the Bolivar, the national currency, is it's completely worthless. In fact, when criminals rob you in Venezuela, they rob you of like your durable goods and stuff like that, not your money, because it has no value. Also, you're seeing the emergence of crypto. Bitcoin is really popular over there, and a lot of people are turning to that, especially amongst the more tech-savvy Venezuelans.
I remember reading about that, about how cryptocurrency is it's like a lifeboat for them, and which is wonderful. It's a great case, a great illustration of the usefulness of cryptocurrency in these kinds of situations where the state is genuinely robbing you at an enormous rate. One great quote from Peter Schiff, I remember when he said, "Taxation is when the state steals your money." But inflation is when you still have your money, but they steal the value of your money. And I thought that was a wonderful illustration.
Yes, that's actually a really good point. This goes back to my point about like tax revolts. Most tax revolts emerge whenever the state has confiscatory levels of taxation.
Right.
Whereas inflation, is definitely like a more of a creeping phenomena where the value of like your money loses, like depreciates over time. And in the more extreme cases like Venezuela, it will basically turn into a form of theft because it's basically the money printers and the groups that see the money first that are the ones that benefit the most. Then the rest of the people get the scraps, meaning they get monopoly money. Yeah. At best, when it comes to the value.
Yeah, when I tell people about inflation, and how terrible and insidious it is, a frequent response I get is like, well, it's not that bad because if they print the money and then they spend it, it goes into circulation. It's like water. You pour water in a big tub, it's just going to, even out very quickly. Whereas I think Friedrich Hayek, he stated that no, inflation is more like dropping, like a dollop of honey onto a plate and how slowly that, assimilates and spreads out. That's how slowly, everything else evens out and the price, everyone's like, well, everyone's wages go up and, prices do go up, but the wages do go up. So it's not that bad, but no, it's more like, it doesn't spread fast and even out fast. It spreads very slowly. And the people that, as you said, that benefit are the first users, right? The state and all the corporations that deal with the state and, the politicians and things like that.
Yes, the Yeah, it's actually pretty bad that people think like inflation is normal,
right,
when it's a monetary phenomenon. Yeah, central banking has become kind of like a baseline of sorts, like almost like furniture in the living room that everybody takes as a given. Like they kind of see it, but they don't understand that this stuff is actually like abnormal when you think about it. That's just like the centuries worth of progressive era statism combined with the state indoctrination centers that are public schools and just a cultural acceptance of like the state in our lives that has conditioned us into believing that central banking is normal. The idea of like a monopolized bank printing out excessive amount of money is normal. And the result is it's going to be a collapse one way or the other. Mm-hmm. Once the modern day welfare state collapses, I think it's just going to go downhill from there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, one example I'd like to use to illustrate the idea of inflation is, you know, people, especially people who advocate for minimum wage, we need $15 living wage, right? And so I tell them, you know, before 1965, the minimum wage was 5 quarters. But the difference is those quarters were 90% silver, right? And so if you were to take those same quarters and buy them today, I think one quarter is roughly equal to $5 today, right? So 90% silver quarters as a minimum wage in 1964 pays much more than the minimum wage today of what, $7.50, $8. if each one is $5, this was a $25 for minimum wage. So I always like, that's one thing to illustrate how, you know, how much the currency has been destroyed.
Actually, it's funny you mention minimum wage, Danilo, because Venezuela has done tons of minimum wage increases over the past few years due to the inflation. And it's done nothing but just like kill their private sector.
Sure.
And that's the thing too about the inflation death spiral is that once like your country's in fiscal dire straits and the government starts cranking out the printing presses, it turns into a vicious cycle of more inflation and thus more intervention because people think, oh, if we can just like legislate higher wages, that'll fix everything, but it won't. It's just going to create another set of problems like unemployment. And then the politicians are going to double down and say, oh, we need to like increase unemployment insurance. It's just like a downward spiral of economic statism that will just destroy a country.
Yeah, one intervention leads to another intervention leads to another. And it kind of reminds me of ancient Rome in his series Mike Maloney mentioned ancient Rome. I think it was Emperor Diocletian when there was hyperinflation going on and the currency just being destroyed, you know, they're clipping the coins and diluting it with other base metals. And so prices began to rise. So people were blaming, of course, the business owners, right? Evil capitalist business owners, stop fleecing the people. And so what'd they do? They passed a law, I think it was called the Edict of Prices, which was basically a price ceiling. You cannot raise your price past this point. And you know, what ends up happening? Either people close down or you go to the black market, right? And they do it under the table. So either way, it gets done or people lose.
Yes, and in fact, like, that's another great historical lesson. Price controls are as ancient as ancient Western civilization, and Venezuela has plenty of price controls, price ceilings, and all those wacky government edicts. And the result has been the same: massive shortages, just destruction of the private sector, and like these arguments of like corruption and mismanagement. Like, they're kind of correct, but they don't go further. They don't understand this corruption, mismanagement is a feature of socialism because socialism tries to play God with an economy that has its own laws. The laws of economics are strong and you can try to subvert them as much as possible, but they will end up biting you in the rear in the long term.
Yeah. Biting in the rear indeed. Yeah. I mean, what was I going to say? I remember reading about how Venezuela, the average Venezuelan has lost like 20 pounds since the past couple of years, something like that, because, you know, of all the starvation and shortages, and now people are resorting to, you know, like scavenging for rats and what, pigeons or zoo animals and things like that. Yeah. What can you tell us about that?
Well, socialism is the ultimate crash diet, if you think about it.
Right.
Because all the shortages and destruction of private property just makes it impossible to produce goods on the market.
Right.
I've heard like some really like huge horror stories where like dogs on the streets are like non-existent.
Yeah.
And you just put two and two together what's
right.
happening.
Right.
And that's the thing as well, that actually animal rights people, they should be like in favor of capitalism, because animals are treated so much better in capitalist westernized countries because of the fact that there is private property, there is respect for like the rule of law and like the non-aggression principle for the most part. But the food shortages are pretty bad, and it doesn't help either that there's also a lot of exchange controls that don't allow for the entrance of foreign currencies and speculation. So it's become very, very bad. A lot of sectors, including like the airline sector, they've had to cancel flights. So because of the lack of dollars in the economy and foreign investment due to these controls. So if you're a Venezuelan that's trying to get out of the country, you have to probably go by foot or by bus or whatever, if even the bus infrastructure exists, because a lot of basic infrastructure in Venezuela is just gone kaput because of the institutional uncertainty and economic destruction that socialism has brought about in the country.
Yeah, I've heard that it's getting more and more difficult for people to leave, and that the end goal is that the borders will eventually be shut down completely and people will be prevented from leaving. Have you heard that as well?
I mean, I definitely see that, because I mean, it's kind of like the Berlin Wall as well. It was like designed to keep the East Germans in. And there are some other measures that the Venezuelan government has made, where they brought what's called an alcalbala, which is like a medieval type of highway tax, where literally government officials that are essentially highway robbers can stop you at any checkpoint and charge you a fee. And if you can't pay this fee, they will not allow you to pass.
Wow.
It's a form of highway robbery, and all this stuff has popped up. And even if they don't close the border directly, they'll essentially make it impossible for people to leave, especially for people with very little resources. You will probably have to risk certain starvation or something like that to get out of the country and live and like go through really dangerous parts of the country. So it's a very nasty situation that will keep a lot of people from potentially leaving.
Yeah. So, okay, so people listening to this and everything that's going on, it sounds so dismal and dark. And so what would you say, like, if they say, okay, so what's your solution? How does Venezuela get out of this? What would you say to somebody like that?
I'd say that keep promoting crypto in Venezuela, especially Bitcoin. I do believe crypto does solve a lot of the problems of fiat money, and especially like state-controlled money. Because the unique value proposition of crypto is people voluntarily transact in it and give it value through their use, and they do this in a free market environment. Whereas fiat money is just done because some bureaucrat, politician, or whatever drafts up a law or an ordinance and says, this is the money of the land, take it or leave it. Or you get thrown in jail for that. But I think as well, I would say private defense can play a huge role too. With the rise of defense distributed and like 3D printable firearms, I think that could play a huge role in liberating the country without having to go to using a traditional government in military intervention. I think that we do have a lot of 21st century technology that could disintermediate the state in Venezuela and countless other repressive regimes.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Technology is definitely the savior of humanity. I remember learning about during the Soviet Union time how, you know, since there are such immense shortages in terms of food and medicine, how the only way that they were actually surviving and getting food is through the black markets, as well as medicine keeping them healthy, it was through the black markets. I assume that's a similar case in Venezuela?
Yeah, the black market is massive in Venezuela. That's where you get the dollars, you get the food, airline tickets, everything. It's obviously marked up, but that's how people survive. Mm-hmm. And it's actually really messed up too, because the Venezuelan government has actually tried to crack down on a lot of these black market sellers that are called bachaqueros. Hmm. Bachaqueros is literally leaf cutter ant in Venezuelan Spanish.
Hmm.
And these people will have like black market goods and sell them at a premium. And politicians will complain, like, oh my gosh, why are you selling this stuff so marked up when we're like in such inflation? And the reality is it's because there's such terrible price controls. These people responding in a way to like correct for these government inefficiencies. And unfortunately, most people don't think in those terms, and they just think, oh, we need to throw these people in jail. We need to like crack down on this. It's like I said, it's a death spiral of economic stupidity on display.
Yeah. Yeah. It reminded me of, you know, the idea of price gouging. And, you know, when there's a disaster, like a, you know, hurricane or you know, earthquake or flood or something, and, you know, the population is completely destroyed, houses crumble to the ground. And then people come in with like maybe food or generators or water and charge, you know, exorbitant prices. And of course you got the, you know, the bleeding heart people. What is it, the liberals or Democrats, and, you know, you people are just taking advantage of other people that are hurting and in need. And just like you said, you know, they're responding to economic incentive. You know, it's like, this is where resources are needed, right? And so they're going in there and they're selling. Like, what are you doing? You're just on Twitter complaining that this person is actually there helping these people, giving them stuff, you know? And eventually what ends up happening is, because of the incentive for profit, it incentivizes other people to come in and bring their resources. And so what ends up happening? Due to competition, the price goes back down, back to where it should be, back to parity. So the economic ignorance is staggering.
You nailed it, Danilo. That's how markets work. But for a lot of ivory tower bobbleheads that we see in the media and throughout legacy institutions, that kind of stuff just flies over their heads. Modern day politics is all about satisfying short term whims and consolidating political support. And those types of environments are just terrible for any type of large scale economic growth and like human development. And unfortunately, it's starting to become in vogue in a lot of the first world in the West. And it's going to turn out the same, just like how it did in Rome, how it did in Venezuela. And it's pretty sad that people still don't really read up on their history.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, what do they say? You start off in sandals and you know, climb the mountain, and then you're in glass, you're in your silk slippers, and then you descend back in sandals. It's a cycle, right? People sure. Don't learn. They don't learn from history. And it kind of reminds me, there's another cartoon I remember seeing where a person goes to jail and they see three people there, and it says, what are you in for? And one guy's like, oh, I raised my prices too high, I'm for price gouging. And the other person's like, I set my prices too low, I was charged with predatory pricing. And the third person says, well, my prices were just like everyone else, so I was charged with collusion.
That's government land for you.
You can't win. It's like, you know, the book by Harvey Silverglate, was it Three Felonies a Day, right? How the feds was it harm the innocent or control the innocent? Like how, you know, there's so many taxes, so many regulations, so many laws that if you were to come under the you know, the eye of Sauron of the state for any reason, you know, they could sift through your background, through your paperwork, through your history, and they will find somewhere, somehow, a place where you violated a law. Or not even that. Just go on the highway. How many people drive below the speed limit, right? like people violating the laws every single day. So we're all criminals.
Yes, there's like a very good quote, I think, by the Roman historian Tacitus, where he says, like, the more laws there are in a nation, the more corrupt it is. Just paraphrasing. Yeah. I might have butchered it completely, but yeah, it's like, it's what happens when you let politicians set policy instead of civil society and basic cultural norms and courtesy be the, like, the main drivers of social organization. And yeah, this type of stuff has been transported all over the world, especially the third world. A lot of the third world, as from my travels and my experiences living in countries like Chile, a lot of people think that the first world is rich because they have welfare states and stuff like that. It's completely off base. And unfortunately, these countries are paying the price for it. And it's going to come full circle back to the U.S. too, because the current climate really just is infatuated with socialism, with the idea that handouts will solve your problems immediately.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a lesson that seems like every few generations we have to learn again, unfortunately. And, you know, we have those few people who understand the process and the pattern. And, you know, we're the writers, the authors, the podcasters, the YouTubers that are trying to warn everyone else as much as possible. And thankfully, I think with the internet, it's so much easier to warn other people because of the just explosion of content, of information, you know, and the ability to figure this stuff out and research it is so much easier than it used to be. And so I think that, you know, the century of, you know, the 20th century of socialism is, you know, I think that will be a bygone era, hopefully. I think the internet is expediting the process of educating the masses. So what do you think?
I agree with you as well, Danilo. The internet has been a very powerful tool in unmasking a lot of, like, the disinformation we've seen on socialist propaganda. And a lot more people now, at least when you compare it to, say, the 20th century, they know about Austrian economics. They know about sound money. They know about how central planning is not how you organize a society. And the internet has empowered all of these people, and they've become, like you said, podcasters, thought leaders, entrepreneurs that advocate for these ideas. That's why I tell people, like, it's not all doom and gloom. No. I do think there are some bad macro trends out there, but if people put in the work and become more compelling as libertarian advocates, we can see a total tidal shift, a tidal wave of opinion shift in our favor.
Yeah, yeah, it's not all doom and gloom. I think that's also very important to emphasize, especially on a topic like this. So in closing, so maybe give your final remarks about Venezuela and you know, what you see the very near future happening with them. And, you know, hopefully it'll be like, you know, just ripping off a Band-Aid and it'll be quick and it'll be over. But I'm not assuming everyone's going to emerge, you know, a libertarian, Austrian economic voluntarist. But I don't know. Hopefully they'll learn their lesson at least for a few generations.
Well, I think with Venezuela, it's the poster child of modern-day socialist failure. Like, if you just look at the country, it has, like, practically all of, like, the templates and communist manifesto, and it's almost followed it to a T, and it has failed to a T as well. If you want to look at what socialism is, Venezuela is your exhibit A. Now, as far as the future of Venezuela, I think in the short to midterm, I'm very pessimistic. I think the country is just going to continue to go into the economic doldrums. Long term, who knows, because I think with the rise of Bitcoin and cryptocurrency, a lot of people now are turning to that as an alternative to the destructive fiat regime that the country's been subjected to over the past 80 years. And I think with technology advancing and knowledge spreading, the country will probably get back to its feet long term.
Yeah. Yeah. One can only hope, right? So before we go, I ask this of all my guests. What is your favorite quote of all time?
Well, that one's, that's a tough one.
Yeah. So many good ones, right?
Yes. I would say Ludwig von Mises's quote about, I'm just paraphrasing this, sure. I don't know the exact wording, about every socialist is a disguised dictator. That's my
I love it. Yeah, or kind of the way I describe democracy, which is like instead of, you know, people putting their faith in, you know, a king or a politician, you know, democracy is everybody's a little mini dictator trying to control their neighbor.
You know? That's what it essentially is. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So. So yeah, the idea is freedom, voluntarism. The idea is, you know, live your life and respect the property rights, the self-ownership of other people if you wish them to respect them in you. I think that's the overarching message that I try to convey, and I believe you try to convey as well. It's a simple message, you know, but it seems like it's a tough pill to swallow for most people. But, you know, we're doing our best. You know, you're doing your wonderful work with your writing, with the articles on Mises.org. So please, everyone, check that out. Jose Nino on Mises.org, as well as Facebook and Twitter. Jose Nino, he's putting out some wonderful content. So go on and support him. And yeah, so thanks a lot for coming on the show, Jose. I really appreciate it. So this is Peaceful Anarchism on the Voluntary Virtues Network. On theconsciousresistance.com and solpodcast.org. Wishing all of you have a wonderful day. Take care.
Bye. It was a pleasure chatting with you, Daniel. Thank you for having me on.
Pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this content and would like to see more of it, please feel free to donate and help me interview other fascinating people. You can do so through Patreon. That's patreon.com/peacefulanarchism to help me out. $1 a show is all I ask. If you feel so inclined to donate more, please feel free. It will only assist me in spreading the message of freedom and voluntarism that much farther and that much more efficiently. You can also donate to my Bitcoin. My Bitcoin address is in the description to my videos, as well as on my website, peacefulanarchism.com. And while you're on my site, there's a donate button to donate through PayPal. If you prefer to donate through PayPal, you can do so with that. But Patreon is a little bit easier for content creators, as you can set up a recurring donation if you so desire. Also, while you're on my website, peacefulanarchism.com, please feel free to sign up, enter your email address, sign up for my newsletter, and you'll receive updates every time I post something, a video or an interview. I do not send out any spam. Or you can also follow me on Facebook, under facebook.com/peacefulanarchism or facebook.com/DaniloCuellar3, I believe. DaniloCuellar3. So either one of those methods, if you are able to donate, I would be most appreciative. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you have a magnificent day.
Cell 411 is a free app for Android and iOS that replaces government-controlled 911. Cell 411 allows you to preset a group of friends or private organizations to show up in any emergency. Cell 411 is a nightmare for the state because it proves their so-called services aren't needed. Cell 411 has had thousands of installs, and of course it's covered by the BIPCOT no government license. Cell 411, because your friends won't shoot you when you're in trouble. Without the government, who would build the emergency services? You and Cell 411. Get it today at GetCell411.com. That's GetCell411.com.